Hello and welcome to the I'm Learning Mandarin podcast. Coming up on today's podcast, I discuss the input hypothesis and the ideas of influential linguist Stephen Krashen with two Mandarin learning experts. Also in today's episode, I talk with I'm Learning Mandarin illustrator Essie Burtz, who has an exciting announcement about some events we're organising which we think you might be interested in. Okay, so on to today's announcement then. So for today's announcement, I've invited Essie Burtz, who is the I'm Learning Mandarin illustrator, and also someone who's appeared on this podcast previously as well. So Essie, for anyone who doesn't know you, would you like to just briefly introduce yourself again?
Hey, yeah, of course. So I'm Essie. It's really nice to be back on the podcast. Also, I'm very flattered to be called an illustrator because it's not something I've been doing for very long, but I really enjoy doing the pictures for the blog. Thank you for inviting me to come and chat about things today.
Okay, so Essie, so tell us a bit more about what this announcement is all about.
Yeah, sure. So the announcement we want to make on the podcast today is about how we're planning to organise a series of immersion weekends in the UK. They're for people who want the opportunity to immerse themselves in Mandarin, but who, for whatever reason, would find it difficult to travel to China at the moment and want a chance to really boost their listening and speaking by being in a fully Chinese-speaking environment.
Absolutely, yeah, because this is something that's come up a lot in the Facebook group that we're all a part of, where we talk regularly about, like, our Chinese learning journey. And one of the things that's come up for everyone is that we've mostly been in a situation where we're living outside of China, learning Chinese during the pandemic period, and there's not really been the opportunity to go to China or to be in an immersive environment. And for that reason, we've sort of been, a few of us, looking for these kind of opportunities. But whenever I've done a search online for immersive opportunities or like immersion camps, it's not really something that exists, at least in the UK, that I've found. Is that sort of like, I think your experience has been similar, right?
Oh, 100%. And I know we've both discussed how frustrating this is, really, because we feel like there must be other nerds like us out there who would be really keen to do something like this and who would similarly just find it difficult to travel abroad at the moment. It's a big commitment. Because I've looked at some of these immersion programs in China myself, and not even just the situation around the pandemic is difficult, even disregarding that. From a cost point of view, from the amount of time that you need to set aside to travel there, it can feel like a really daunting thing to do. And I love this idea that you could maybe try and get a taste of what immersion is like in a much easier way in the UK. I think it's really fantastic.
Totally. And like we actually managed to organise one of these events just for a group of us a couple of weekends ago, and unfortunately you weren't able to go on that one, but I had the opportunity to go on it. And basically there was about eight of us, four Chinese people, four English native speakers learning Chinese, and the only rule was no English allowed except for emergencies. And we just basically spoke Chinese all weekend. And that's basically the first time I've ever had that experience. And I've just blogged about it, where I'm completely immersed in language, completely surrounded. I've had lots of experiences where I'm speaking Chinese for hours on end, but that's kind of different to when you're actually just completely immersed for the entire weekend with no English at all. And I found that it just had like a major impact on my confidence and spoken fluency. It just kind of activated all the hard work that I'd done over the previous years. Just by the end of at the beginning, I was feeling quite apprehensive and nervous, and by the end, I just felt like more fluent than I'd ever been before. And so we just thought that it would be like really good to be able to open this up for more people. And so I guess what we're trying to do now is find out more about what people who are potentially interested in this kind of opportunity, how they would want us to structure these events, what locations would be most ideal, or what kind of time frame would you like to spend, like the entire weekend or two nights or just one night, or this kind of thing. So we've created a survey. And where can people find out more than Essie about this opportunity?
Yeah, so you can find the survey on your latest blog, and you can also read more about the experience there. And I'd really encourage everyone that's interested to register their interest by the survey and answer some of those questions that you mentioned to help us create the best experience for everyone. And I really love how in the blog you describe a bit more about what it was like and what the benefits you got from it. I just found that, well, the main emotion I felt was jealousy, let's be honest. And it's made me feel really excited about being able to offer this to other people as well. So I really encourage everyone to go and check out those two links that can both be found on your latest blog, right?
Yeah, and both links can be found in the description to this podcast. So if anybody's interested, then please just click the links, find out more there, and fill out the survey to register your interest, and also let us know more about how you would like these events to be structured in the future. So once again, thank you very much, Esther, for coming on the podcast, and hopefully we'll have you back soon.
Yeah, thanks, Harry.
Professor Stephen Krashen has arguably had more of an impact in the field of modern language education than any other living academic linguist. His input hypothesis, a group of five hypotheses developed in the 70s and 80s, argues that comprehensible input is the key component required for successful second language acquisition. Language education in schools and universities has traditionally been based on the belief that practicing speaking, vocabulary memorization, repetition drills, and grammar rules are the keys to learning a second language. According to Krashen, however, studying information about languages in the form of grammar rules and practicing speaking through repetition drills are of marginal importance. Instead, we acquire languages when we understand messages through reading and listening to our target language. If we follow his principles, our task as language learners is simple. Seek out reading and listening material we find compelling and comprehensible, then consume enough of it until we've internalized the language. If we get enough comprehensible input appropriate to our level, our comprehension skills will consistently improve and our ability to speak the language will then gradually emerge. The online language learning community is full of influencers and learners, including myself, who've been inspired by Krashen. The likes of Steve Kaufman and Matt vs. Japan, who I interviewed on this podcast, are examples of what can be achieved when Krashen's principles are applied successfully. But Krashen is not without his critics, and there are question marks over how applicable his ideas are to learning Mandarin in particular. Can Mandarin pronunciation and tones be acquired through comprehensible input alone, or is it necessary to learn rules, use rote memorization and repetition drills to become proficient? And what about grammar? Can we acquire Mandarin grammar to a high level without deliberately studying the rules governing Chinese grammar? In this episode, I want to take a critical look at the input hypothesis. To do so, I've invited two Mandarin learning experts, both of whom have appeared on this podcast before. Professor Karen Chung is a linguist with decades of experience working at National Taiwan University. Daniel Malesnik is the founder of the leading flashcard app, Hack Chinese. Together, we explore the strengths and limitations of the input hypothesis in the context of learning Mandarin. Okay, so thanks very much, everyone, for coming. So first of all, I was wondering, you've both been on this podcast before, so I was wondering whether you could just remind everyone who you are with a brief introduction. So Daniel, would you like to go first?
Sure. Thanks for having me back, Misha. This is a real pleasure. My name is Dan Nalesnik. I learned Mandarin Chinese as an adult when I was 25 years old, starting with going to the country and spending a year in classes, the very traditional sort of, you know, rote memorization, lots of repeating drills, that type of thing. After a year of incredibly inefficient methods, still managed to make some progress. And in the time since then, that's been about a decade, have since created a language learning company called Hack Chinese around those concepts. So very happy to be here.
Thank you. And Karen?
Yes, thank you again for having me on the program. I'm really honored. I am Karen Zhong. I taught English and linguistics and phonetics at Taiwan University for 30 years, recently retired. I now teach part-time. And I grew up with German at home. My father taught me and took a lot of European languages, but somehow they just were not me, and I kept looking for my language. And one summer, I took a course in Chinese studies, and I found my language. And from then, Chinese was sort of like a religion for me. I went to classes at the University of Minnesota while I was still in high school. I audited the classes and eventually majored in it at the University of Minnesota. And I studied in Taiwan for a couple years in a master's program. Went back to do grad work at Princeton in East Asian Studies, and I've just been involved in Chinese ever since.
Perfect, and I thoroughly recommend that all our listeners go back and listen to the full interview podcast that I did with each of you, because they're really interesting, full of insights, really go through all of your stories in more depth. The topic for today, though, is we're going to specifically be talking about the ideas of Stephen Krashen and the input hypothesis. And so to begin with, I was wondering whether we could each go through briefly sort of our experiences of learning Chinese in the context of input. So the role that input and the ideas within the input hypothesis of comprehensible input, what role did this play in each of our language learning journeys? So Daniel, how about you? So what kind of role did that play for you?
So when I first went to China, I was in Beijing University and then later Shanghai University. I basically followed the curriculum and the learning paths that they set out. And there was a lot to do, so there wasn't too much outside of the sort of the curriculum that they designed that you were, you know, could freely do whatever you wanted. It was basically follow the textbook, memorize the vocabulary, you know, do some of the exercises, that type of thing. And, you know, like I said, after a year of this, I had achieved test-wise around HSK level 4. I felt comfortable holding conversations, that type of thing. But I didn't know the term comprehensive input at the time, but afterwards I realized kind of how much I had missed that. Not in terms of the fact that I never did it, I certainly did, but I should have been basically doubling down or spending a lot more time reading and listening than I had. And once I did switch over to that when I left the country, and it was really one of those, one of the only options I had was comprehensive input at that point. There was way fewer opportunities to sit in a classroom and do exercises and all that sort of stuff. I actually noticed my progress accelerating quite a bit. So Krashen's hypotheses of, you know, acquisition being something that comes through comprehensive input seems on the surface to be meaningful and probably quite accurate. There are other things that we can tease out of it later, but in principle, I think it's spot on.
Karen, it's interesting because you started learning Mandarin at a time before the input hypothesis had been formalized, I believe. So it's not that like the idea of input was new, though, because that would have played an extremely important role in the initial stages of your Chinese learning.
I think that it was always clear to me as I was majoring in Chinese at the University of Minnesota and taking regular classes that there were two separate lives in Chinese. One was going to class and doing the homework, and our teachers spoke mostly in Chinese in class, at least some of them, the native speakers did. And that was usually easy to follow because he was really, really good at teacher speak. So he used simple words and slowly enough and clearly enough, spoke clearly enough, that we could almost always follow him in class. And that was starting from like second year Chinese. So class was one thing. And then learning how to read and write, that also mostly belonged to the class life. But then I hung around with Taiwanese students and friends outside of class. And then they were just speaking normally among themselves. And that was a whole different world. And I didn't understand most of the time. I was just learning. I also had the idea ever since I started Chinese that I would never learn Chinese well. I couldn't possibly learn Chinese well. I'd learned European languages to pretty good fluency, and I grew up with German, so that wasn't an issue. But without all of those cognates and all of this assumed background knowledge of European languages that they share in common, I just assumed it was impossible to learn Chinese that well. And I had a dream once that I was a Chinese princess, and I thought, oh, this is obviously a dream because I'm speaking Chinese. So I just believed it wasn't really possible, but I loved it. I didn't really care. So I did the classroom thing, and then I hung around with my friends. And as I mentioned in the previous interview, there was one friend in particular who I saw practically every day and who was like a saint. I mean, he was just so patient with me and would laugh things off and tell me how to do them right. And I think I also mentioned at the end of a couple years together, he says, I'm never going to do this with anybody else. It's too exhausting. And so that was basically where I got my comprehensible input. And it was far from comprehensible at the beginning. It was not just comprehensible input, but it was all kinds of feedback, interpreting for me when I didn't get it, correcting me when I got it wrong, and then giving me times to repeat things. So it wasn't just plain comprehensible input for me.
Yeah, my experience personally was that like I learned Chinese for about 2 years, during which period I was using all kinds of different apps. I had absolutely no idea about comprehensible input or really how to go about learning a language at all. And it was just like a hobby in my spare time around work. I wasn't living in China. I was in the UK and still am. And I came across comprehensible input probably about 2 years in because I took a trip to Taiwan. And after 2 years of learning, realized I couldn't understand anything and couldn't really say anything properly. So I realized I needed to do some more serious research about like how adults learn languages. And that's when I came across the input hypothesis, Stephen Krashen, and various other sort of influencers and YouTubers who talk about these issues and who are advocates of Krashenite ideas. That made a huge impact on me, because from then on I started deliberately seeking out comprehensible input, and mainly in the form of initially reading graded readers and using apps like and websites like LinkU. And that was the first time that like I really saw like major progress in terms of both comprehension and ability to speak. So I think it's kind of important to preface this podcast with some positive statements about the profound impact that these ideas had on me and how beneficial it was, because I'm going to at some point say some more critical things about where I might have slight disagreements with the input hypothesis, but it's and its applications to Mandarin potentially. But to begin with, I just wanted to make it clear that it basically saved my Mandarin learning. If it wasn't for having discovered that, I don't think I would have ended up learning Mandarin to any reasonable level.
I would like to say that my contact with Krashen and his ideas came sort of after I'd figured out the same thing myself, but it wasn't because of Chinese. It was because of teaching English. So I have noticed that there is a huge divide in English learning across the world. There are countries where people speak extremely well, and you don't know how they pick it up so well, but they just really do. And then you find countries where they've been through English classes for more than 10 years, and they cannot speak at all. They can't understand. Their English is really poor. And the funny thing is, it's not just in Asian countries. There are a lot of European countries where this is the case, like Spain. And it's totally shocking because English and Spanish are so similar. And so I started looking into this because my students were extremely, extremely good and hardworking students, and they did well on the tests, but they were really, really, really poor at listening and speaking. So I just kind of agonized over this for years, and then I also studied in the Netherlands where English is so good. And eventually I concluded that it's because they have just simply not heard enough English. They have mostly gotten English from written texts. It's poorly delivered by their teachers here, excuse me, in general, not all of the teachers, but in general, the teachers do not speak really fluent, very idiomatic English with good pronunciation. So they have hardly been exposed to English spoken the way native speakers speak it. And then I started digging in more deeply to that. And that's when I really got into Krashen. And I thought, yes, this is what we're missing. So in this sort of prelude where you're making a lot of positive comments about Krashen, I want to add mine. And I still feel very strongly he's made a huge contribution. And we really need to double down on comprehensible input in English teaching.
Absolutely. I think whatever problems there are with comprehensible input, they're kind of within the details. And overall, I think a much more prevalent problem than anything related to comprehensible input as a concept, much more prevalent problems are that people don't have enough comprehensible input. Like, that's a much more common problem than the problem of like people placing too much faith in comprehensible input or believing that it's going to cure everything, which we'll get into.
Yeah, I really, really agree with you on this. And a lot of times when you have people arguing very strongly for two different sides, usually both are valid and you just have to find the right balance.
Mm. I want to talk about balance, because one of the things that's very important to Krashen is this distinction between acquisition versus learning. So for Krashen, acquisition is kind of the subconscious aspect where basically you have lots of comprehensible input, and then without studying specific rules or without being specifically conscious of any particular aspects of the language, you gradually acquire the ability to understand it and then later on produce it. Whereas learning for Krashen is where you're consciously paying attention to aspects of the language, such as grammar rules or phonetic components of the language and that kind of thing. And I'm wondering, in both of your Chinese learning journeys, we could start with you, Daniel, what was the balance between, would you say, between acquisition versus learning in Stephen Krashen's sense?
It definitely leaned extremely heavily towards learning in the beginning. I mean, all the classes were, especially at the beginner level, 90% learning vocabulary, learning simple grammar rules. You might read a paragraph or two, but it was essentially just like giving you some of the basic foundation stuff. And I think at some point, maybe it swings the other way. It did for me anyway, where it became, okay, now a better use of my time and what I was doing was just absorbing content. But I think for me, if I look at acquisition versus learning, Krashen says that acquisition is the only thing that really matters. And the reason that somehow rubs me the wrong way is because it seems like, or at least for me, I needed to do some learning in order to make anything comprehensible at all. And he had, in one of his older videos, actually, you were kind enough to send it to us as preparation, but I had seen it before too. This is, I think, from maybe the 70s. Krashen is giving a speech, and he gives two, like, 30-second lessons in German. And in one, he basically speaks with a lot of high-level German, advanced vocabulary and things, and says, okay, how did you like that lesson? And obviously, everybody in the audience was like, well, it was terrible. I didn't get anything from it. I felt intimidated. And in the second 30 seconds, he gives, I guess, what is the, like, comprehensive input version of a lesson, where he draws a few pictures. He very simply points out features of somebody's face and repeats vocab a couple times. And obviously, everybody in the audience kind of liked it better. Did they, like, learn much German? No, but maybe if they had several hours of that, they would pick up some vocabulary and things. My issue is not that comprehensive input in that way would not be absolutely great. It's that pragmatically, unless you have a mother figure who is going to treat you kind of like he was to those folks in the class for so many hours, for so often, you kind of need a way to get the rest of the world to be comprehensive to you. And so that's, to me, where some learning comes into play. So for me, it was, you know, at one point learning lots of vocabulary and then doing graded readers. And then from there, also, you know, watching TV and other things. But I don't think, besides maybe one time when I was around about to leave China, I was like, oh, let me try to watch some television shows that were definitely way above my level. And they were incomprehensible at the time. And it was, like, so challenging. I just thought to myself, this is so unenjoyable. Why would I do this? Why wouldn't I just either choose something significantly easier or make things easier by learning some of the pieces that fit into that puzzle? So,
yeah, the video that you cite, like, I will put a link to that in the description, and it's really worth watching, because Krashen does this wonderful demonstration where he gives this brief lesson in German, as you just noted. And I think there's a second problem with this in terms of its application to Mandarin, which is that it's much easier to do with German because there's many more cognates, there's many more words which are similar to English. So in this presentation, you'll notice that without having studied any German, you will be able to almost understand it fully because there's so many words which are similar. And because he's also using visuals and that kind of thing. But I think it's a lot more challenging to do that for Mandarin at the beginning. Karen, I was wondering whether you could tell us about the balance that acquisition versus learning, the kind of balance that you struck there when you were learning Chinese.
For Chinese, it became very clear to me that the crucial learning that I was getting that would lead to eventually being able to actually speak and understand Chinese was largely coming to me out of class. But I really, really valued everything we did in class. And that also made me able to ask more of the right questions outside of class and to clear up things that I didn't know how to do. So I feel that I'm very, very happy and satisfied with the Chinese education I got in class at the university. But I also know that I don't think I would have crossed the threshold into actually speaking and understanding Chinese without hanging out with my friends. So that was my personal balance. I think where it's hit me the most is, again, in English teaching, because teaching just a few years, I could see that things were not really going well. I wasn't really helping them improve if I wasn't going to do something different from what they were used to. And so I started assigning audio passages to them. I used to use cassette tapes. Now we use podcasts and things, and they do transcriptions or they do fill in the blanks. Now it's mostly transcriptions to make sure they get every word. And that has really, really changed things. So I found that in class, first of all, I said, what's your purpose? What's your goal in learning English? Is it just to get your degree, you know, pass the class and get your grades? Or do you want to learn English well? If you want to learn English well, you're going to have to do a lot of stuff outside of class because your classes are not teaching you this. And so the place that hit me hardest is in my English teaching. And I think it's been extremely helpful and effective.
Absolutely. I think it's interesting because the problems that I've had in language learning, once I discovered comprehensible input, so after that 2-year mark where I went to Taiwan, realized I didn't know any Chinese and started immersing in comprehensible input. So I did that for the next 2 years. And the problems I've had are kind of coming from the opposite angle to Daniel and also some of the students that you mentioned, Karen, because for me, it was eventually I realized that I had too much faith in the input hypothesis, that I thought that like just through immersion, I would be able to acquire everything. And I wasn't doing any study at all. So I wasn't really paying attention to grammar at all. I wasn't paying attention to phonetics at all. I just thought, if I get more input, these issues will resolve themselves. And that's where, like, I kind of realized there may be some kind of gaps in the input hypothesis, at least in terms of its application to Mandarin, despite the fact that it helped me immensely, because the one thing that it definitely did was improve my comprehension ability so that I was able to get better and better understanding listening and reading. Certainly it did that. And also gradually I was able to begin speaking, although as I learned later, there were major flaws in my conversational abilities and my production. So I wanted to get into talking about the potential gaps in the input hypothesis in terms of Mandarin. I think one of the first things I want to dwell on is this transition from pure input and comprehension skills, improving your comprehension skills, to production and speaking, because there's a kind of impression that's sometimes given by both Krashen and some of his more extreme followers that basically this is a seamless transition. And I found that's partially true for Mandarin. After having a ton of input, my speaking ability did gradually start to emerge, but that there were specific aspects of it that just didn't improve with just more input. Daniel, I wonder if you had any comments to make about that, whether you had any experiences related to this.
I want to say one thing, which is that there's this phrase, I forget who said it, but something like, all models are wrong, but some are useful. And in this case, it seems like perhaps the opposite is true. Perhaps this, you know, the input being the only thing that is really necessary is maybe that's true, maybe that is correct. But pragmatically, if I had to spend any significant amount of time without the, like, sheer excitement that came from having conversations with people, however elementary they were at different levels, at every stage, you know, those are the things that gave me so much excitement and kept me feeling like, okay, I can continue through the, whether it's a slog of just trying to listen to things you don't quite understand or do other things like, you know, studying, even if that's evil. I feel like those are the things that really matter in the real world. I think for most people, they're going to need to supplement their learning with something that is not just basically consuming, especially in the beginning levels when everything is so challenging. You want to take a moment to celebrate the wins. And for me, that was always like, have a conversation, however small it may be.
I have something I think that's kind of important to add to this, but I'll start with two examples. My examples usually come from like English, and I'm now working on my French because those are more recent and I can really feel the effects immediately. One of them is a student can have pretty good English, but then in class, we will cover the difference between ear and year. And they just look at me, they go, there's a difference, ear, year, ear, year. And they're just so shocked. And to teach it takes quite a bit of effort. And once they get it, they get it. They can do it fine. But it takes a lot of work. I have to go around the class and then have each person produce it individually, and then I give them feedback. And then a few people don't get it. I say, go to this and this or this other classmate and learn from them because they've got it. So all the people who got it, I said, it's you. The people who didn't get it, go to those classmates. And then they eventually get it. The other thing is with French, okay, I did it in high school. I was a pretty good student and let it go for many years, picked it up as a bucket item list. And I went to France in the summer of 2019. But it was a workcation, so I was at home working a lot. I didn't actually go out and speak a lot of French except when I needed like a SIM card or something or to rent a bike. But those few times when I was absolutely forced to use French, those were the ones that really stuck in memory. So for example, when I was at the airport, I ate up all the crumbs of my sandwich and this old man next to me said, rien gaspillé. And that intonation, the words he chose are just, they are branded into my brain. So just about every time I had a successful interaction with a French person, naturally, that one really stuck with me and that helped me learn it well. A lot of things that I have learned through listening to podcasts and other things, some will stick, some I need repeated a lot. So what I'm getting to is there is a key to all of this, and that is feedback. To me, that is the sine qua non of learning a language well. And that's why I think I made it over the threshold with Chinese, was because I had a person who gave me accurate feedback, who wasn't afraid to tell me when I got it wrong. And that's what's missing. So if you say, well, book study doesn't work in classroom, teaching of grammar and stuff doesn't work, you just need a lot of input. You sit home and you listen to a podcast and you can fall asleep. I mean, it's very good for if you have insomnia. and you might get some things, but unless you actually produce it yourself, you're not going to get very far. And then Siri is really helpful. So I started saying, quelle est la température? And I found I couldn't say température without stuttering. So Siri helped me for really basic things. But Siri doesn't go much beyond the weather and the time and bad jokes. And also Siri's reactions are fake. She's not reacting to something I said with a sincere laugh or anything. And so there was really a limit with those, unlike what I felt in France. So my point is, what you need is feedback. And that's the hardest thing to get. If you find a really good online exchange, man, you better really treasure it and make the best of it. If you get a person who can give you feedback, tell you when you're wrong, have you say it until you get it right, and then you can move on. That's what you have to do. So to me, that is the missing piece in this whole thing, is feedback.
I think it's particularly crucial for Chinese, specifically because of tones.
Yes.
So I didn't acquire tones naturally. I immersed for 2 years and they just weren't improving. They weren't getting better. And to some degree, this was a blind spot. And then one day someone pointed it out to me rather brutally. And then I decided I wanted to do something about it. But the main thing that like really helped me when it came to doing something about it wasn't just immersing more. It was specifically finding a tutor who was willing to correct me on my tone mistakes. And I'm just not sure how this fits in with the input hypothesis.
I think that's the key to everything that you've hit on.
Daniel, what was kind of your experience with tones?
I guess in the very, very beginning, I didn't like them. But then it sort of became something that, I don't know, maybe my tones are still not great, but it is not an issue. Maybe one day I'll meet your friend who is brutal to you and it will like rock my world. But it seems like with enough listening, but and enough practice and enough, I certainly had tutors who would, even to this day still, who will correct tones if I say something particularly wrong. You know, I think it's kind of heralded as this like crazy challenging thing nobody can overcome. And to me, it has seemed like with the right practice, with the right feedback, almost everybody can overcome it. It takes some people less time, some people more time, but...
Yeah, I think there are two golden keys here. One is feedback, and the other one is the one Daniel mentioned of the excitement you get from a conversation. I don't think there's anything that can replace that. Those two things are needed, and you will naturally find your motivation to get things right when you've got those two. It's not going to happen just sitting at home doing your duty, listening to the news every morning in your target language.
The second kind of blind spot that I wanted to cover is grammar. This is a blind spot that a lot of Chinese learners, I think, have. A lot of learners of all languages have. But particularly Chinese, like I often hear people say, like, Chinese grammar is very logical. Chinese grammar is very simple. And I used to think that too, until I like decided to get like brutal feedback on grammar as well as tones. And then my Chinese teacher would start like correcting every single sentence that I was saying. And in order to like bridge that gap, I found that more input, again, wasn't really helping that much. And I had to like take certain interventional methods. The main one that I'm currently doing at the moment is sentence mining, which is extremely effective. It's where you collect hundreds of like sentences with key structures and you like drill them with spaced repetition systems. So you bombard yourself with them again and again. Eventually you develop more of a sense of the language that way. But I wonder if either of you have any comments on Chinese grammar and how that relates to the input hypothesis.
In my experience, I felt like grammar was way too much the focus in the beginning. But I wouldn't say reduce it to zero. I would say reduce it a lot. But I think the ideal structure for me, or rather, let me phrase it this way. When somebody asks me how should they go about learning Chinese if they're at the very beginning stages, I usually tell them to, amongst other things, get a beginner textbook and learn the absolute basics. Or this is the equivalent to like going through Duolingo, right? You're not really achieving much, but you're learning the absolute basics, and then you can get some material, whether it's graded readers or other textbooks, whatever, and ignore all the grammar exercises, learn the vocabulary. Of course, I always think learning the vocabulary is a good use of time, and then start reading things, reading the paragraphs. If you don't understand something, if you know all the words in a sentence and you don't understand what it means, you know, assuming it's not a vocabulary problem because that's relatively easy to solve, then it's probably a grammar issue. And it's at that point where I feel like reaching for some sort of explanation, some surgical, you know, attack of that sentence with what is the grammar that's going on here? How does it work? That's like a great time in my mind for you to apply that and actually absorb something from it. what is very standard is in classes you like learn a grammar pattern and then get some examples, learn a grammar pattern and get some examples, and that's of significantly less value than needing a grammar pattern, like not knowing something and wanting to know it in terms of a sentence or something that you've heard or read, and then realizing, oh, this is the key, this is the grammar key that makes these words in this order make sense. That seems to be more useful.
I wanted to ask first if you think that the amount of grammar that should be taught when you're learning or covered when you're learning Chinese is something like a Pareto ratio, like 20% grammar and 80% everything else?
Yeah, probably. I mean, I don't know if that particular ratio is exactly correct, but I think significantly less specific direct grammar instruction is absorbable. I won't say it's not useful, but it's not the right time to absorb it, I think. If you look at the standard textbook and you move from chapter 1 to chapter 2, it's like, okay, you've read 5 paragraphs and now you're going to be introduced to 6 more grammar patterns. That's not the right ratio.
I have a grandniece. Her father came from China. My father-in-law left a son in China, and then we brought his son to Taiwan to get educated. His daughter, okay, that's the relationship. So she went to usual Taiwanese schools. Her English was like anybody else. But then she went to Thailand a couple years to an international school, and she learned quite a bit of English. But she was very young then. Recently, she spent 2 years at an international school in Bahrain. So she acquired English there. She didn't really learn it like you'd learn it in a classroom. She really acquired it. And there are quite a few gaps in it, but she's fluent and she's colloquial, idiomatic, and her pronunciation is very good. So she doesn't know anything about grammar. And that's a problem for her because she's now back in the Taiwan school system. So I said, you know, you really have to learn grammar. So she started working through a Taiwan published book on English grammar. And she says, what's the difference between 主词 and 主格? And we're talking about subject. I go, okay, now we're going to start from subject, verb, object, and work from there. And so we kind of got it, sort of like, I give you the ball. So I am the subject and ball is the object here. And then I said, she also had a question about articles. She says, well, what's a definite article and a definite article? So I said, okay, I give you a ball. How do you say that in Chinese? 我给你一个球. I said, no problem. So a ball, did we know anything about that ball before? She said, no, it's any old ball, doesn't matter. I go, that's exactly right. That's an indefinite article. That means we didn't know about it before. It's an information value kind of marker. Okay, how about if we both knew about the ball? So I gave you the ball. And I said, how would you say that in Chinese? And she was trying to think, because she's trying to figure out the equivalence in Chinese of and the. And we had no problem with because 一个 is a pretty good equivalent. But with the, she said, 我给你球. And I said, does that sound right? She says, it sounds kind of awkward. And so we kind of, you know, went back and forth on it. She says, 球给我. And when I said, no, the sentence was, give me the ball, give me the ball. And it wasn't, 你给我球, it was 球给我. And she says, that's it. That's the way we say it when it's the ball. So the ball, that means we put it at the beginning and there's nothing in front of the 球, 球给我, that's normal. If you say 给我球, it sounds rude and it's not really the way people usually speak. And she got excited because she figured it out. I said, you got it. So that means that English the is equivalent to what in Chinese? And we figured out it's nothing. It doesn't mean that there's no equivalent. There is an equivalent. It's a zero marker. So when it is something we both know about ahead of time, we use the because it's a definite article that we use for the noun. And then often the old information, things we know about, they go at the beginning of the sentence. We already know about it. It's that ball. What about the ball? Give it to me. So that's how we learned about topic comment. And she got really excited. She said, I never heard of that before. And she said, great aunt, how in the world did you learn that? How did you figure that out? And I said, well, I learned it in Chinese class in Minnesota. And she just got totally excited. I said, now do you see the problem when they're trying to teach English with subject, verb, object, and then they just translate it directly into Chinese, 给我球, without mentioning that it doesn't sound right, and that if you have a definite article, you're going to have to get into topic comment in Chinese. And topic comment and SVO are kind of at odds with each other. SVO is not going to work. Some places you're going to have to mess up SVO. And so the grammar books, they never mention it. The Chinese classes don't mention it. The English teaching classes don't mention it. And so people are just totally in the dark about what's going on. And that is one of the most basic things about English and Chinese grammar when you're trying to combine the two, is you learn about topic comment. You learn why is it a topic? Because it's old information. Old information gets no marker in Chinese. It gets the in English, and you're going to have to move it. So this was just a huge revelation to her. She got excited. In the past, she would give kind of perfunctory answers, and she would mix things up and not. I mean, she's a good student, and she's very well behaved. But it wasn't like it was exciting her enough that she was going to try to pay attention and not get it wrong next time. This time, she'll get it right. She went home, and she told her father about it. And her father got all worked up, and she said, and he said, what do you mean topic comment? He was just doubting the whole proposition. He said, well, you can do it in English too. He said, book you can read. No, we don't say it that way. So it was like an unconventional idea that just kind of ruined the paradigm and upset people. And I think if we tried to do this in Taiwan and teach things properly so they match things up right, it would be like a revolution. You know, people will resist it strongly because nobody does it. So I guess what I'm saying is, yes, you do need very explicit instruction, but you got to know what the heck you're doing, and people don't.
But I think that one of the ways in which this would probably contradict some of Krashen's ideas is that Krashen has a concept which he talks about a lot called the monitor, which is that when you teach people explicit knowledge and to be conscious of certain aspects of the language, like the grammar points that you just mentioned there, Karen, what we need to then do in order to apply this is to constantly consciously monitor our speech and make amendments, self-edit in our minds before actually speaking. So if we've just learned a grammar point when we're speaking, we need to actually like consciously monitor the contents of our speech before we say them, and then we say them out loud, having edited them already. And he says that this is a very inefficient way of working, that a much better way of working is to take advantage of the subconscious language acquisition and then just speak without needing to think about it. I wonder what either of you think about this monitor problem. Do you think that like the monitor can be an efficient mechanism?
When I read about specifically the concept of the monitor, it did speak to me. It does seem like there's not enough time in the course of a normal conversation to pull in much of what you've studied and learned that way. On that point, it seems like there's something there. One point about the monitor that he mentioned was you can use the monitor in controlled environments like exams and things. And while an exam is not real life, studying for and preparing for that exam and passing that exam has some pragmatic benefits. So kind of falling back to, yeah, this may be true, but so what? Is kind of where I stand.
Okay, so my experience with this is we definitely do have that monitor, and it operates automatically. It's our unconscious brain that's constantly monitoring everything we speak. And when we're speaking our native language, if we make a mistake, you know, if we just make any kind of a mistake, we hear it and go, oops, no, and we'll fix it immediately because our brain is saying that doesn't match the file that I've got up here. You're going to have to fix that. That happens to everybody in their native language. And I think it can happen in the language you're acquiring once you've crossed that threshold I mentioned, once you've got over that, whatever is keeping you back from speaking fluently and understanding most of everything. There's a certain threshold where you go from intermediate to high intermediate and advanced. I don't think that unless you're over that threshold, the monitor is really that well functioning because you just don't have enough good stuff stuffed in your brain yet. That's my feeling. So it's like it comes too late to be useful. And for language learning, the really tough part is the purgatory of being at the intermediate level. It's going from that purgatory over the threshold into fluency and comfort and naturalness. At that point, you don't really need any help from Krashen or anybody else. You figured it out yourself. And then your brain is already helping you, picking up things naturally. Because I noticed I was doing a lot of things naturally in Chinese I wasn't even aware of. But I picked it up because I was already fluent enough that it could just slip in. Before you've crossed that threshold, you've just got too many things to pay attention to for that monitor to be really effective and to kick in by itself.
I have a slightly different take on the monitor from my own experiences, which is that like I'm in favor of it in the sense that I think for getting better at specific, maybe we could call them blind spots, or specific areas where we've reached fossilization. We've had a ton of input. We've been studying for a long time. We haven't got better at a specific thing, like, for example, in my case, tones. I think the monitor can be an extremely effective mechanism for improving. So what happened with me was that after I realized my tones were bad, started doing something about it, I went back and made sure I was memorizing all of the tones for all of the characters and tone pairs correctly. And then when I spoke, of course, I sounded like a robot and I had to think really hard and I was speaking extremely slowly and it was extremely laborious and all of the things that Stephen Krashen warns everyone about. So he's completely right about that. But the whole point about it was that it was a temporary phase. It was a necessary temporary phase to correct my deviations in speech. And then over time, all of those things that I had to think really hard to be able to like say properly, like for example, there's like four third tones together in a row and my mind has to do all kinds of mental calculations. Over time, those mental calculations just got swifter and swifter and swifter and the monitor just became more and more and more efficient until eventually it didn't feel like it was even there and I was just able to like speak very freely. So I think it's a mistake to kind of get rid of the monitor altogether. I was watching a video, which was really interesting. I'll put a link to it, which was an interview that Matt versus Japan, who I've also interviewed on this podcast, he did an interview with Stephen Krashen, where he put some questions to him specifically about pitch accent. And there are lots of similarities between pitch accent and tones, because lots of Japanese learners, most Japanese learners will complain after reaching a certain level that they haven't, through immersion alone, acquired pitch accent perfectly. And at that point, Matt versus Japan was having some issues with his own pitch accent. And so he asked him the question, where this fitted in with his input hypothesis. So Stephen Krashen replied that he says the language acquisition device never shuts off, it's always there. You've acquired all these things already and the perfect Japanese accent is inside of you. That's a quote from him. And then Stephen Krashen asked Matt versus Japan, do you get it right when you monitor it? And Matt versus Japan replied, well, not fully, it's kind of too complicated to monitor. And then so Stephen Krashen said, so you've made my point, so active monitoring is not very efficient. But my take on that was actually that Matt versus Japan, who actually his pitch accent is very good now, he was in a temporary phase at that point where he was active monitoring was very laborious. But that doesn't mean that it's a bad thing. It just means it's a temporary thing.
Absolutely. Now, I want to respond to that if I can, because this is what I tell my students. We're talking about two different monitors here. So when you say that you have a different take on it, it's because you're talking about a different monitor. The monitor I was talking about is what Chomsky, and I'm not a Chomsky person, by the way, calls the checker. So you've got this checker in your head that goes over the sentence you've produced and tells you if it's correct and makes sure everything is right. We have that checker. It's a function of our brain. So that's how we as native speakers can say something wrong and immediately correct it because it just doesn't sound right. That's the kind of monitor I was talking about. The kind of monitor that you're talking about is consciously putting into practice what you have learned to correct that you were doing wrong before. And that's a different kind. We'll call yours monitor one, mine is monitor two. All right. So for monitor one, I also teach that because the students come to me with very defective pronunciation. And when I point things out, they go, oh, there's so much to fix. I said, that's okay. Just take one thing. One thing, ear and year. Let's just work on ear and year and take about 2 weeks to maybe a month and be very, very conscious of every time it's east or yeast, ear or year, you're paying attention so you don't say last ear. So I'll say that you're going to have to be conscious of it. It's going to be painful. And there are not that many words with the ee contrast. But for example, name, that they consistently pronounce nim, I go, you're going to have to watch that A sound before a nasal. And you're going to have to really, really monitor what you're saying. Fix it. Try to fix it before you say it and then fix it after if you didn't fix it in time. But just really be conscious of it. Pay attention to it. And you're going to suffer for a month to 6 weeks. But then it will become automatic. And that's the monitoring that you're talking about. And that's a different thing. And that is truly important. And I also tell them it's a temporary thing. You just suffer for 6 weeks, you'll get it, and then move on to the next thing.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering if we could sort of move on to talking about another key concept that Krashen talks about, which is that sort of something he's never quite said explicitly, but something he alludes to quite a lot is that it was previously believed that the language acquisition faculty shuts off after puberty, and that basically after that we can only learn languages by completely paying conscious attention through explicit knowledge entirely. And he is kind of a reaction against that. And he has a quote where he says, "We know that language acquisition of all ages runs on the same engine, which is basically comprehension of what you hear and read. And it's extremely difficult to apply conscious knowledge to language." So this is coming back to what we were just talking about there. But the concept he alludes to over and over again is trying to minimize the distinction between child language acquisition and adult language acquisition. And to this end, I think the critical age hypothesis, if it's true, and depending how important it is, might pose some problems to the input hypothesis. Is this something either of you have any kind of ideas on or any views on?
If you look at adult learners who learn a language, you know, starting from way past the age where it should make a difference, some are able to make it to an advanced level. So that at least proves that it's not impossible. Basically, everybody's able to, as a child, become native in at least one language. So there is, you know, it's quite compelling an argument to say, oh, it's easy as a child, but kids work really hard too.
Yeah, I guess like the controversy probably isn't whether or not like adults can reach a high level. It's probably more to do with like the way in which adults reach a high level versus children. And the controversy is like, do adults really need much more explicit knowledge than children do? Do children have this major advantage in terms of just being able to, the whole process almost exclusively being subconscious and based on implicit knowledge? And I guess like a couple of things that come up for me with this is that I think there are very clear differences that I observe in all of the learners that I've interviewed on this podcast, for example, at the level of pronunciation, that nobody was basically able to acquire this in the way a child would. Nobody was completely unconscious of the process of learning tones, of the process of getting good at Chinese pronunciation. Everybody had to have explicit knowledge in order to get good at those things. And there are other examples that we've kind of talked about with grammar. So I kind of do think there are major differences. You were going to come in there, Karen.
Oh, yeah. So first of all, there's a neurological difference between kids and adults that should be addressed. Because you note that kids will copy anything. Babies do not have filters. They will just accept everything you give them. So just about anything that you learn up until like the first grade and after, you think that that is set in stone. That is the gospel truth of the whole world for the rest of your life, because you learned it at a time before you had a filter and you simply accepted whatever came in. All the input came in and lodged itself and stayed there. And as you mature, you start putting filters in place. And a lot of people talk about this critical age hypothesis. By about the time of puberty, you've got a lot of filters in place. You're not going to just accept everything you're given. And that's the one really big difference. Another one is the magnet effect that they talk about. It happens by about 18 months in babies and children. By about 18 months, they no longer care about the difference between zh and le in Japanese because they're in the same space, while an English speaker will. For them, it's two totally different phonemes. So those are two neurological, physical differences, organic differences between children and adults. So they are there. The thing is that although the filters are there as you get older, you can learn things consciously by deciding to override the filters. You can decide you don't want to listen to authority. You can decide you like this better. You'd rather listen to your father than your mother. All kinds of things that you can do to override filters that may be in place. So I think that adults, while they have filters, they have a heck of a lot of other advantages that kids don't have. And one of them is higher cognitive development. And that means you can understand things and generalize about things much more quickly because you have so much cognitive experience. And you will find that rules will save time. That's what I tell my students, because some people, especially people in the same field, colleagues, they often don't really even agree with trying to teach pronunciation to university students in English. They think you're just trying to turn them into little Minnesotans, or they have all kinds of things that they say. And I say, no, it's not that. And it's really that rules will save you time. If I give you a rule, it suddenly makes sense. And now you can work on it on your own and save a heck of a lot of time. And that's a huge advantage that adults have. And every time my students have a question that I can't answer right away, they sort of demand that I find a rule and give it to them because they don't want to waste time trying to figure out something that's kind of trivial, but it's driving them nuts because they keep getting it wrong. So rules are hugely useful. So book learning is useful. It gets kind of back to Pareto. If you spend about 20% of your time working on that stuff, and then the rest of your time practicing and getting feedback, you probably do very well because that's a better balance. And one other thing about not just picking things up automatically, I have to mention something about the Southeast Asians that come to Taiwan. They come here to work because they have to support their families. Many of them, they've got a wife or husband back in Indonesia or the Philippines, and they have to speak Chinese in order to do their job. A lot of them are caregivers or they're laborers. They have to learn Chinese quickly. So it's none of this stuff about, oh, I'm having trouble with my tones. They just sit down and learn it. And I've asked many of them, you know, how the heck did you do it? She says, oh, just by listening, I picked it up. So a lot of them come from languages that are not tone languages. Tagalog is not a tone language and Indonesian is not a tone language. But my gosh, they speak really good Chinese and they keep telling me, oh, they had maybe like 6 weeks of Chinese class and the rest they did on their own. So something is going on here. I think there's another factor to bring in, and that is urgency. So we do it because we're privileged Westerners with a liberal arts education. We can do a lot of things because we choose to. These people are not choosing. I mean, they really didn't have much choice if they wanted to be able to do better in life. So they came here and they just had to do it, and they did it fast and they did it well.
Yeah, it's very interesting because I hear stories about people who were able to pick up aspects of Chinese that naturally in a way that I wasn't, and I, like tones and that kind of thing. I do hear these stories. I don't encounter many people, specifically the people I've interviewed on my podcast. But like you say, that might be one of the crucial factors that's missing. Most of the people on my podcast are describing their language learning journeys coming from a situation where they don't like actually have to learn for necessity. So I do wonder if that's like a crucial component.
I remember, Misha, last time we chatted, we talked about how when I had spent time in China with the explicit purpose of learning Chinese, it was a battle for me to find situations where people weren't rushing to speak to me in English, even in Beijing and Shanghai and other things. And I contrasted that with, I went to grad school in the US and there were lots of, I can't remember the English, 同学, I can't remember the English word. There were lots of classmates who came from China, and their English, when they got to the program, was okay. But within just 1 year, it was like so much better, because exactly the same. They needed to use it. Like, nobody was speaking to them in Chinese, with the exception of me, and they were probably like, what are you doing?
Absolutely. So I had like this experience like a couple of weekends ago, which was the first time I've ever had this experience learning Chinese in the UK. It's not necessary for me to learn language, but I put myself in a situation for the first time where I went on a weekend away with a bunch of Chinese friends. And for the first time, this was my first experience of complete immersion for days on end. And the one rule was like no English allowed. So there was a couple of a few English people, a few Chinese people, and we were staying together in the same house, going hiking, doing different activities. And it just made all the difference. It just made such a difference. It's like to everything, to vocabulary acquisition, to just think, especially at a certain level where you've acquired a certain amount of the language anyway. In that sense, it makes a huge difference.
Yeah. And what you had in that situation was a lot of emotional interactions. I don't mean emotionally emotional in the sense of crying at the drop of a hat, but we don't know. But when you are interacting with people, I mean, humans, as humans, we are such social creatures. We just thrive on interaction. We do really badly when we don't get enough of it. And one thing we really, really love about it is any kind of emotional connection. And when you've got that with language learning, it's really potent, I think.
So I was wondering if we could finish by sort of summarizing where we broadly stand, each of us, on the issues that we've discussed. So if I can start myself, I think that it's been a really interesting discussion. And I guess, like, it's in many respects confirmed a lot of the things that I already thought and that we're probably broadly in agreement with, which is that, like, to a large extent, we should all be extremely grateful to Stephen Krashen. And anybody who's listening who hasn't heard of Stephen Krashen should look up more information about him and his contribution, particularly in terms of highlighting the importance of comprehensible input and input in general when language learning, can't be understated. And at the same time, I think that it's possible to go too far in a crash night direction, and in particular when thinking about tools, which are, I think, can be extremely effective in terms of the monitor that we've been talking about, which shouldn't be discarded. So I guess that's broadly where I would stand. I wonder if either of you would like to kind of contribute where you broadly stand.
Sure. So very similar to you, I think Krashen's ideas of comprehensive input are massively important. I don't think it's the only thing. Even Krashen mentioned in an interview where he went to Austria he went to Austria and was there for a while and learned so much through comprehensive input, but he also prefaced with that was following a year of studying German. It was preparing to be able to absorb things when it was available to him. So to me, I think you need to find what excites you about the language. And so if that is strictly comprehensive input, fine. But if it's going to be having conversations to get you excited like I am or other things, then don't worry that there's not just one single way. Massively important are his ideas for sure. But there are some other things you should tack on.
Yeah, I think I'm largely in agreement with you too, but there's a couple things I'd add. One thing is that book learning has always been important in Chinese culture, because I'm reading the Zhuzhuan these days, and China was already a deeply entrenched bureaucracy by then that placed a very, very high premium on book learning. And my personal opinion as a linguist is that Chinese could not possibly be what it is today, Mandarin especially, with all of those homophones and everything else, without the written language. I believe the written language has had a very, very deep influence on the growth and development of Chinese. It simply could not be the way it is without writing to disambiguate and to give depth to the stuff that we use when we're speaking. So writing and book learning, I think, are absolutely crucial for Chinese. You just don't do Chinese without it. If you do it without it, you will be kind of like a worker on the wharves, you know, the servidors in Shanghai. You know, they can sort of get by with a minimum of language, but you're not going to go very deep, and Chinese listening to you are not going to be very happy with it. And I noticed that Benny addressed that too, is that listeners are not happy with his approach. Well, that's tough. You know, I'm just going to use my Tarzan language. I'm sorry, it does not work in Chinese. It just does not. You will not flourish in this language and culture if you use Tarzan Chinese. So at the base of that, you're going to need book learning. You need to learn how to write. Whether you learn this, you should learn the stroke order, but, you know, it's more important now to learn the characters. You need that book learning as a base. Also, I think what really needs to be added into Krashen's theories is the whole issue of feedback and emotional interaction. I don't see that much in his work about that, but that for me was really the deciding factor in learning Chinese. You know, those have to be incorporated into any theory, or you've just got another theory that's nice on paper. So I guess that's, you know, my view. So it's a matter of balance.
Brilliant. Well, that's been a really fascinating discussion. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as me. So thank you very much, everybody, for joining us today. And once again, thank you for joining the podcast, Daniel and Karen.
Thank you so much, Misha and Daniel. It's been a huge pleasure.
Yeah, thanks, Misha, for inviting us. It's great to talk.
Hey there. Thanks for listening to this episode of the I'm Learning Mandarin podcast. If you're currently looking to improve your Mandarin speaking skills, you might like to check out my Peak Mandarin newsletter. Run by me and my friend Will Hart, we share exactly what you need to do to become fluent in Chinese based on our experience. Subscribe to the newsletter and we'll also send you a free copy of my ebook, Lessons from a Chinese Learning Phenomenon, which tells the story of exactly how Will Hart learned to speak near native level Chinese within a 1.5 year period, how I put his techniques into practice to become fluent myself, and how you can too. To subscribe to the newsletter, you can go to peakmandarin.com or click the link in the description. That's all for now. Until next episode, goodbye.